Welcome to another exciting episode of NID's Knowledge, this one being Real Space Strategy Edition. This podcast is produced by the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we will inform you about the latest in space strategy and its importance to our national defense. Well, hello once again. Thank you again for joining us for Real Space Strategy. I'm Christopher Stone. And last episode, I gave a brief introductory commentary on competitive endurance, which is the white paper of the Space Force put out in January, and how it seemed to me that a lot of it was very U.S. focused and didn't really have a whole lot of meat regarding one of our major, as they call, pacing challenges, which is the Chinese. And so this week, we're very fortunate to have with us Dr. Kevin Polpeter, who's with the China Aerospace Studies Institute now, recently made the shift over from CNA. And he's a China expert. I've known him for several years, got to help him out with a RAND study he did back when the Strategic Support Force was a new thing. So, Kevin, thanks again for joining us here on Real Space Strategy.
Thanks for having me.
Awesome. So, as I mentioned in the last episode, I began looking into the Space Force's concept. And one of my assessments that it was lacking any insight into Chinese strategic culture or its manifestations in military space strategy and operating concepts. And I'm grateful to have you on. I know you understand this area quite well and wanted to discuss this further. So the first thing I wanted to do is let's lay the foundation of understanding here a little bit. So mirror imaging, which is projecting our own worldview and understanding intentions and other things on other nations that don't hold to that view, is an issue that U.S. strategy and policy has faced for decades. It's not a new problem, but it keeps continuing to be an issue. And as you and I both know, and I've mentioned on previous podcasts here, China does have a unique worldview about itself and how space power fits into their quest for. And I think it was your paper, one of your China Commission efforts, that I think you said they're pushing for wealth and power. So how does China see the U.S. and the U.S.-led international order, and why?
Okay, so I guess we have to take a look at it that the U.S. and China see the world almost in exact opposites. The PRC sees the U.S. as a destabilizing influence on the international order. You know, to use our phrasing, they would view us as a malign force in the world. They say that we are too quick to unilaterally use force. We don't go through the UN. We are too quick to advocate and carry out regime change. We are too easy to judge other countries and the legitimacy of their political systems, and that we view it through a narrow lens of democracy and human rights. And they would say that if, you know, they say, hey, look around the world, there's chaos happening all over, and that the U.S. is a main reason for that. On the other hand, right, China views itself or portrays itself as sort of the kinder, gentler superpower, right? It's out there. It's not prone to use force. It loves to work through the United Nations. This is the way China perceives it, right? It treats all countries as equal, regardless of development level and political system. And so their mantra is that they want to build a community of shared future for mankind. Kind, right? It's sort of a mouthful, but it's everybody living in peace and harmony. And so what they say is that actually the Chinese way, right, is the better way to run the world, where there's actually promoting democracy at the nation state level rather than within, you know, sort of domestically. And I think sometimes, we here in the U.S. may say, whoa, really? Is that, you know, do we, you know, China sort of, you know, going off the rails here. But I think in many parts of the developing world that will have some, that argument gains some traction.
It's kind of weird when you say that they think that we don't go through the U.N. when they're the first to ignore ICJ rulings, like in the South China Sea with the Philippines and all the on the space side in particular, all the UN COP US votes and pushes for reaffirming Outer Space Treaty and other things of that sort, which, you know, as you and I both have discussed before, a lot of this is narrative building, and it really isn't so much the facts of what how their behavior is, and it's what their narrative is. So that doesn't necessarily connect the dots, right? Their behavior, their strategic behavior, as I mentioned last week, John Boyd said that is the real information. I mean, yeah, they may say something, but their behavior is what should be the real measure of a nation. Does that sound right to you?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So there is this narrative where China's trying to win sort of the hearts and minds of the world, especially the developing world. But if you look closer, you know, there's some big gaps in the rhetoric and the actions of China. And if I can take a detour here a little bit and apply that to space, because that's really why we're here for. And so what you see is that you see this space is sort of a subset of how China views the world and how the Chinese Communist Party carries out its policy. Then you also see that policy being carried out within its space program. And so what you see is that China has this, you know, building a community of shared interest, right? And then so they say their tagline is building a community of shared interest in space, right? So China, again, is trying then to portray itself as the responsible space power, right? They are the ones that are going out trying to help the developing world develop their space program, trying to provide the benefits of space to the developing world. On the other hand, they portray the United States as having a Cold War mentality in space, that we have been trying to restrict China's rise, you know, through export controls, through laws against cooperation with China. And then they say, hey, you know, the U.S. is claiming that we're, you know, weaponizing space, but then they will point to, you know, lots of technologies that the U.S. is building. They point to Operation Burnt Frost. They point to the 1997 Miracle laser test. What really drives them up the wall is the X-37B, right? Because they're envisioning all sorts of nasty applications for the X-37B, whether it's remote sensing or whether it's has some sort of counter space capability. You know, they point out that we're conducting Shriva war games. And so they're building this narrative then that the destabilizing influence in space is actually the U.S., not China.
Which is also interesting because back when I used to teach graduate school, I taught a space policy course at Missouri State. And one of my students who wrote a really great paper that she eventually published in a strategy peer reviewed journal about BeiDou, their GPS system. And her title was it's a constellation of vassalage, because it was being tied into the Belt and Road Initiative and the point to where it's now linking all these developing countries' infrastructure under Chinese control through their timing signals. And so it's kind of a high-tech version of the old tributary system that the old Chinese dynasties, when they, you know, before the whole opium wars and century of humiliation concepts that became their mantra for the last 100-plus years, that they considered themselves to be the center of the universe, center of the, you know, the whole Middle Kingdom. And I have heard, and since I don't speak Mandarin and you do, that China in Mandarin means the center or something to that effect. Is that accurate?
Right.
Central?
Exactly.
Okay. So when I see that and I hear their narrative again, you know, I just find that interesting. And I guess I can use this as a jumping off point to the next thing. So because they have this, as you said, polar opposite viewpoint of the world and space and themselves and us, its role in the world and beyond, why then is China, in China's view, why are they pursuing what they term as real capabilities, real weapon systems that they say are designed for rapid and destructive warfare in space, it doesn't seem like the narratives we have been pushing out of Space Force and at UN meetings and committees have seemingly resonated with the Chinese, but they essentially do what they want regardless. So why the buildup of offensive space forces, both ground-based and space-based, and then, as we saw a few years ago, their fractional orbital bombardment system, hypersonic glide vehicle test, space to ground. So, from your experience, what have you found in the writings and in the behavior?
Yeah. So, if you look at almost any major Chinese writing on space, you will see the line that space is the ultimate high ground, right? Mm-hmm. That you can't achieve victory on the Earth if you do not have control of space. And really what China has been doing is studying the way the U.S. military has operated since the 1991 Gulf War. And they've come to realize how important space is to the U.S. military in the way modern war is conducted. And these are their figures, not mine, but what they say is that the U.S. uses space-based ISR for 70 to 80% of its intelligence, that the U.S. uses satellites for 80% of its communications. And first they say, hey, we got to have some of that, right? We got to be a modern military. On the other hand, they see that this is also an Achilles heel for the U.S., right? It's a tremendous asset for the U.S., but it's also very vulnerable. And so what they say here then is that without space, conducting modern war is not possible, and that the evolution of war will sort of evolve, the evolution of space war will sort of evolve in the same way air power has, right? So you had World War One, you had biplanes flying over the trenches taking pictures, then somebody got the idea to take a rifle up and start shooting at the other guy, and then they put machine guns on them, right? And then you go all the way into strategic bombing, and you have B-2 bombers, whatever, right? So they see that right now we're sort of in that period where the biplanes are flying over the trenches taking pictures, and sooner or later we're going to start arming satellites or start shooting at satellites in much the same way as air power. So they say that they not only have to have sort of the space enablers, the ISR, the satellite navigation, what have you, but then they also need those counter space weapons to take out that U.S. advantage, because they see how much we rely on space.
Yeah, and I guess one of the other interesting things I remember reading in some of the authoritative translations was, speaking of ISR, they, in the Western world, in the United States, the whole point of ISR was for initially the prevention of surprise attack. So you can watch if the bad guys are marshaling their forces to strike us or our allies. But in Chinese writings, they view ISR as, quote, battlefield prep. And I thought that was an interesting difference in perspectives. Is that something that still remains as part of their thinking? Because as a long view kind of country, they don't really change a lot when it comes to their big picture views. But as you mentioned, they're starting to kind of build out some of their support infrastructure for terrestrial operations, air and land and sea. But they seem to have a lot more focus on understanding that space supremacy, space superiority, is not just some sort of rhetorical device, but it's something that is a must. Is that accurate from what you're seeing in the writings and in the behavior?
Right, exactly. So if you don't have that space superiority, you're not going to be able to achieve victory in any of the other domains. So in one sense, also, they've realized what the U.S. military has realized, that if you want to project power, you need space. So if you want to get out there and find that U.S. aircraft carrier, sure, you can use other ships, submarines, over-the-horizon radar, what have you, but space will also play an important role in that. So then what you get into is, is both sides are protecting their own satellites. Both sides realize, you know, where how important space is, and then you get into that space war that they talk about. But I would say that even goes even a level above sort of the tactical or operational use. And mm-hmm. so now what you see is in writings what Chinese call strategic deterrence, and what this is really it's almost like the U.S. concept of integrated deterrence. It's a comprehensive way of looking at it where China is no longer looking at just nuclear forces for deterrence, but they're also looking at space and cyber. And in the context of space, they realize that space is so important, right, that if you develop the capabilities to take out somebody else's space capabilities, that will act as a deterrence. And not only that if your space enablers are so strong, right, if you can conduct those precision strikes at long range, it's also another type of deterrence. So, and they're also looking at the economic angle, right? This isn't just a military issue, that if you take out, you know, the U.S. economy, you know, space is embedded in the U.S. economy as well. Think of, you know, GPS, how do you get, you know, Waze or Google Maps, how do you get to where you need to go, right? You start mm-hmm. taking out those, and then you really hurt the U.S. economy. So it's space now is really a way to reach out and deter the U.S. at a strategic level.
Yeah, and I've noticed also at the operational level that they, unlike us, because it seems like we're always our language, even they've redefined space superiority from what it really is to this new multi-domain, all-domain terrestrial support kind of thing, when it has, that's not what it has ever meant since the space age began in 57. And the Chinese look at it as they're building doctrinal, you know, things such as space blockades and other ways of leveraging their on-orbit weapon systems and their ground-based weapon systems to actually fight battles in space. And yet for some reason, we continue to say, I think this is a big thing to mention. In that competitive endurance document, one of the things they say is like, oh, yeah, they're building all these things. We don't want to make them desperate enough to use it. But yet, when you look at what the Chinese are saying, doing, and practicing, they're talking about, like, it doesn't even have to be a full-up conflict. It could be a period of tension, as they say. Or it could be for psychological reasons. It could be it doesn't have to be yes, they're going to blow up something potentially, or maybe they might do a multi-layered approach, like they call it. But it doesn't have to mean they're going to destroy physical things. They could be blowing something up for a psychological purpose. So they're building actual doctrine for these units that they're deploying to actually use these things in a deterrent standpoint. And speaking of that, let me just get to that. So one other thing that's different about the U.S. and China, I've seen and I've learned and I know we've talked about, is that even the definition in Chinese of deterrence is different.
That's
so,
right, yeah.
So like it's, you know, normally for us, it's where we have a threat in, you know, American traditional views of deterrence. It's a military threat or a threat of some kind that is supposed to impact the mind of the adversary to not attack us. So they know what we have the willingness and the capacity to do something, and we communicate that to them. And if they do something, then we respond. But that's not really true in China. They have a more active approach, right? So I guess explain that, if you would, to the audience.
Right. So the Chinese term is called wei shi, and it's often translated as deterrence. And I now translate that as coercion. And the reason is because when you really look at the way that in the Chinese writings about how they discuss to carry out wei shi, it carries both, there are deterrence acts and then there are acts of compellence. And deterrence then is, you know, preventing somebody from doing something. Compellence is to try and prevent them from continuing to do something. So you can say, hey, here's a red line. Don't don't cross over that red line or I'm going to hit you, right? That's deterrence. Mm-hmm. But if they've already crossed over that red line, you can hit them and say, go back behind the red line. That's compellence. Taken together, that's coercion. And so what you see then is you got to be careful in when you're reading the Chinese sources, because you almost have to take it on a case-by-case basis. But there are mm-hmm. definitely elements where they say, you know, that deterrence is both a wartime and a peacetime, Weisha is both a peacetime and a wartime activity. And so mm-hmm. there is this discussion then when they're talking about Weisha about how they can actually compel other countries. And I'll give you one example. So one article I read about written by 2nd Artillery Corps officer. 2nd Artillery Corps was the strategic rocket force of the PLA before it turned into the rocket force. And they were taking a situation where there was a conflict over Taiwan. The U.S. was not directly involved, but was supplying space-based ISR to Taiwan, and they said if that ISR support became critical, they could shoot down, do a kinetic shot against the U.S. satellite, blow it up, and the U.S. then would realize the error of its ways and stop supplying that intelligence. So there's a sense then that that you can use force against an adversary, and then that they will sort of back down afterwards. What's also interesting, though, is that they say that coercive measures, the writings on space warfare say you can use Weisha as a prelude to war by degrading adversary systems before the war actually starts.
Mm-hmm.
So you can do these compellence measures, start taking out satellites that would then be in a broader, if the enemy doesn't back down, it would be a broader program then of defeating the U.S. in space, even before maybe war officially is carried out.
So I don't know if you've read the actual documents, but a lot of our U.S. policy, especially in the last 15 years or so, for the most part, seems to be written in a way that sounds self-limiting for the United States. It does not seem like it's really proactively trying to go after the threat that was the whole purpose of creating a space force in the begin with. That was the phrase in 2019, was address the threat. And it seems like that maybe from what you're saying with the peacetime, wartime kind of potential uses, for what I've read in other sources, the phrase attack to deter, is there a chance, you think, have you seen anything that indicates that they're looking at our policy as a sign of success in what they're doing? Is, yes, they're concerned enough about space sustainability to where they're not deploying the effective countermeasures, so we're potentially being ahead when it comes to space deterrence and warfighting. Have you seen anything like that at all?
Yeah, I haven't seen anything like that. But what I would say is that they actually the Chinese writings have me more worried, because they assume, even though that, you know, we may not discuss that in the writings, they assume, right, that they can knock out a satellite and that we will stop whatever we're doing. There's mm-hmm. no discussion of, oh, what happens if the adversary continues what it's doing. And it also assumes that the U.S. won't strike back, right? That we'll get our belly full. Oh, we've erred in our ways. We'll stop it. And they also assume that the U.S. will not view it as a prelude to war, when in fact, actually, you know, they do state that in some cases it is a prelude to war. So I just see that there's a lot of room here for miscalculation on the mm-hmm. part of China, that they may in fact misinterpret our true intent or our willingness to continue on with the fight. And that's my big concern, is that they will conduct actions, compellence actions under Weisha, that they think will make us back down, and in fact it will only enrage us.
Yeah, from what I've seen in a lot of places, sometimes I wonder if about that, based on how we've reacted to demonstrations of both kinetic and non-kinetic activities. And as the former Vice Chief of Space Operations, General Thompson, said, on the lower threshold, on the reversible side, we're being attacked daily. And I've seen that in my operational side, in various ways that have been, articulated in hearings and things. But there's one thing that's related to all these kind of self-restraining measures that we're doing to try to show our good intent, but doesn't seem to be having the fruits. And one of them is the resiliency proliferated constellations concept. And the idea was, hey, if we build a bunch of these instead of four big ones, we build like tens to hundreds of these smaller proliferated constellations. It confuses the targeting calculus of the enemy and makes it more difficult. But one thing that I've become familiar with recently is, and I don't know if I read this in one of the China Commission reports, but there was something that I read about system destruction concept, where instead of looking at these proliferated constellations, like Starlink in particular, was an article or a paper written by some Chinese department that got put out in the press, and a friend of mine who can read and speak Mandarin, I wanted to see if that article was legit or not, or if they were just hyping it up. And they talked about, quote, killing Starlink as a system. So they're viewing the constellation as a single target instead of 150, 200 different special targets. Is that something that you think is proof that they're already, prepared to counter that kind of viewpoint of absorbing the hit? And still functioning to the point where they're now thinking, okay, well, they're already going that direction and it's taken a while for us to get there, so they've already shifted their doctrine a bit.
So as you mentioned, the PLA is quite aware of the military uses of Starlink. You see in their writings that they admire it. They think it's pretty capable. You can see, China now has plans for at least four different mega constellations. So they definitely want to get onto that bandwagon. But yeah, they express a lot of worry over it. I think, okay, my personal opinion, I think the proliferated constellation concept is probably necessary. I think it affords us some measure of security. If we are attacked, it provides us maybe some chance to some extra time to recover. But my concern is that, and maybe the space domain is different from other types of warfare, but if you look at the history of warfare, it's replete with examples of somebody coming up with a defense and then the other side coming up with a way to defeat it. And my concern is that we could buy us some time with proliferated constellations, but it will result in our enemies trying to figure out ways to defeat it. We see, Russia developing a nuclear ASAT weapon. Is that in response to Starlink? There is even an article in the South China Morning Post that Chinese research has been looking at a nuclear ASAT. Whether that's true or not, I don't know, but that's out there. So my concern is that, longer down the road is that. Yeah, maybe it's a necessary measure, but you're exactly right that China's probably already looking at ways to defeat Starlink or constellations like it. So I think we need to be, we shouldn't be so confident that we're buying us the level of security that we think we are.
Yeah. So I guess one more quick big picture question, and then we'll do a final one to wrap up today. So one of the things that we didn't touch on yet, and I thought it was interesting, when I was doing studies for my own book and some other papers that I've been writing over the years, is that all wars that the PLA engage in are just wars, and as a result, all actions, whether we consider them to be aggressive or not, they consider them all to be self-defense. Could you unpack that a little bit, since that's definitely a little bit different than the way we view self-defense?
Right, sure. So the Chinese Communist Party says that the PRC has never fought a war of aggression and will never fight a war of aggression, right? Because in their mind, right, the potential flashpoints are all about their sovereignty, whether it's Taiwan or South China Sea, or even if there's some conflagration on the Korean Peninsula, it's you know, they're there to protect their national interests, right? So there is this measure of that they're always going to fight the good war. And it goes back to this moral superiority that we talked about earlier about how China, sort of the kinder, gentler superpower, and that it's really the U.S. that is messing up the world. How this plays out in regards to, you know, military operations and deterrence is that I'm concerned that this feeling of moral superiority will actually make it us less able to deter China from taking actions, because they will always feel that they are in the right. Right, this is a righteous crusade that they will go out and they don't want to be stopped. But then you also mix into it in with that sort of the victimization narrative that China has about how the U.S. has kept China down, how Western countries ever since the 1839 Opium War has kept China down. And so if you look at the academic literature, what comes out in that is that countries with a strong sense of grievance are actually very difficult to deter, right? Because they got to get back whatever they lost. They got to seek some retribution. They got to, you know, get back territory or whatever. So in a deterrence sort of context, it really makes it more difficult to deter China.
Yeah, I think that's kind of funny when they claim grievances when we gave them most favored nation status and a quick track to the WTO and number one trading partner. And I find those narratives interesting. And for those that aren't following history and what's happened over the last 50 years, it's easy to buy into that, I guess. So final question, and I don't know if you have thought of this or not, but I like to ask this question just because of how we kind of come full circle back to U.S. policy and strategy regarding space deterrence and warfighting is, should our policy include an analysis and understanding of Chinese thinking intent and not just their technology? If so, why? If not, why not? And then a second part to this, if we don't, will we still be able to win in a space campaign against China with a mirror image view of them?
Sure. So
easy question for you.
So a little bit of a softball question, considering that I made my career studying China space. But yes. Absolutely, right. In some ways, figuring out the technology is the easy part, right? You can count the number of platforms. Maybe you know how fast they can go, what kind of weapons they can carry, and then you can develop countermeasures against them, right? But you know, you're absolutely right. Not everyone acts the same way as the U.S. military. People don't make the same decisions, you know, as the U.S. military, or even as the U.S. Right? Every military institution is influenced by its culture and its history. So figuring out how China wants to employ its weapons, sort of what cultural and military factors are peculiar to the PLA that may shape that, how well they can employ those technologies, how well are they trained, you know, how are they thinking about things? I think it all goes into presenting a more well-rounded understanding of China that can not only help us better deter China, but can better let us better understand how their actions may lead to escalation, how our actions may lead to escalation, and then finally how we can better defeat China if we were to get into a war with them. So I think it just provides a more well-rounded understanding than just simply you know, counting numbers and capabilities.
Well, I agree with you, and I don't see a lot of that evident in a lot of the vision and the documentation. So hopefully, I've been in meetings where we've discussed policy stuff, and a lot of times I'm just like, did we not think this through a little bit? But we're out of time, and we could go on doing this for a while. And I appreciate I appreciate you making time to come on board with Real Space Strategy today, and very much appreciate your knowledge and your insight into this very important topic.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.
Awesome. Well, this is Christopher Stone for Real Space Strategy. Thanks very much for joining us. Thank you for listening to NIDS Knowledge, Real Space Strategy. The Real Space Strategy Edition is produced under NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent on donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I want to thank our producer, Kimberly Sherrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative NIDS Knowledge.